Last time we talked about the first step in quantizing our model for gravity. So the day before yesterday, we talked about replacing these continuous variables with the holonomy and flux variables that have more manageable Poisson relations between them. So instead of using the continuous connection and triad, we use these holonomies and fluxes that are associated to the edges of graphs. So to begin our quantization of the model, we focus in on a single edge, which means we have a single holonomy and a single flux, which obey the following Poisson commutation relations. So based on the fact that the H's commute with each other and the E's don't, we said it's probably better to quantize H's as multiplication, since we can treat them as just multiplication by a function, since multiplication by a function is going to commute. So that's what we did. We said the operator for H is just going to multiply the wave function by this matrix element. So then in order to get the right commutation relation between the operator for H and the operator for E, we had to make a bit of a guess. But we found that if we use the left invariant derivative on the wave function, that that has the right commutation relation with H. But then in order to make sure that we made the right choice, we had to check that you get the right commutation relation between the different E's. And in fact, you do, so we get a big check for that. And then lastly, we talked about the inner product and the choice of orthonormal basis that we'll use. So the inner product is just given by what looks like the usual inner product from first semester quantum mechanics, but using this special Haar measure on SU2, which is left translation and right translation invariant. And then using that inner product, we can find this orthonormal basis, which is given to us by the Peter Weil theorem, which says you can decompose any function of SU2 into what are essentially like the analog of Fourier modes, which are just the different matrix elements in all the irreducible representations, which are these D, J, M, N functions. So that gives us this resolution of identity, where the J, M, N state is just the one that has this matrix element as its wave function. And that's pretty much where we left it. So.
Okay, great, thanks. Thank you. Okay, yeah, so again, the idea was, so as you see, since we did this kind of replacement here from this continuous variable to what we could call also Cn as discrete variable, right now we're talking just about a truncation of our full system, okay? We just focus on a kind of finite number of degrees of freedom. So, and even yesterday, we just focus on an even smaller subsystem, even not a graph, but just a single edge, okay? So indeed, the function over the group are going to be quantized as multiplication operators. So maybe this notation is a bit misleading, because so indeed, this is a function over the group. It's a matrix elements, but yeah, to write it, you already choose a group element, kind of a group element where you kind of evaluate on it. So, but well, it seems that I guess you understand what you wrote. It's just it's a bit misleading, this notation. And then indeed, the flux variable is going to be quantized as a derivative. And so, since the first step of the Dirac program is to find the kinematical Hilbert space. To talk about a Hilbert space, we need an inner product. So this is what we did, and then the orthonormal basis. So again, we just focus on one edge, and today we're still going to work on this subsystem, and then put all this, because it will be more clear how to put all these pieces together when we have a clear picture of this subsystem. And so we still focus on the kinematical inverse space. So again, I remind that here the idea is we have a system with constraint, and why we focus on the kinematical Hilbert space is because we focus on first, we started from the phase space of all the variable where the we haven't taken into account any of the constraint yet. And so here our subsystem is still an edge, and then hopefully we will go to a graph. But even within this subsystem, we can study already kind of the length operator to kind of give you a kind of what is the geometrical picture that is going to arise from this quantum space. Okay, so here we really try to understand what would be a notion of quantum space. Okay, here we haven't, since we are in the canonical framework, we did the 2 plus 1 splitting in 3D. We haven't really talked about dynamics yet, so let's focus on the notion of space. So Jacob, I think, said it, but just to emphasize, so yesterday I think I said something like you obtain an over-complete basis. No, it's not over-complete, it's just complete. So yeah, it's not. So forget about this part. Just to clarify, this was, I think, maybe the last sentence of my lecture yesterday. So sometimes this kind of thing happens. So thanks, Katie and Alicia, for pointing that out. So now, again, what is our basic operator that we're going to use to compute this length operator is our flux, OK, as an operator. So let's just rewrite what it is. And so again, I'm not going to put any other label here because we just focus on a given edge. And so this left invariant derivative can be written in terms of the right action of the group, where we can I'm just talking about the right action on the group, which is just, and you've seen that in one of the tutorials, that the space of function on the group SU2 carries two natural representations of the group SU2 itself, and it's given by the left and right translation. Okay, they satisfy the you should have checked that they satisfy the representation property, okay, in tutorial. So, and we're going to use that now. So indeed, you can see that kind of the exponentiated flux will be just given by the right multiplication. So let's study what is the right multiplication on this. So also the name given to these matrices is Wigner matrix. Okay, so this. So let's study what is the right action, right multiplication, if you want, on first the Wigner matrices, but then the idea is to get our basis we're going to use now is this set of vector, okay? So our orthonormal basis is we're going to work with is now this set of vectors. And let's see what this means exactly. Okay, so I just want to act. Now I choose a specific function here, which is this. So what does it mean here? Does it just mean I'm multiplying on the right? And now I can use the property of this Wigner matrices that you get. So here, I could use just Einstein summation, but just to make sure that this is clear, let's write it explicitly. Because we need to know which index is transformed, which index is left invariant here. This is the idea. So here the idea is to try to understand, kind of, so as we said, the space of function over the group carry two natural representations. So let's see what this natural, which are the left and right translation. So let's see how this translate on our bases now, okay? So here now, this of course can be seen as evaluated at G acting on, and this one can be also written as G evaluated. Okay, so we can deduce that the action of the right multiplication on my vector basis is just, so here, let's write explicitly again the sum, not just not to get confused. Of G, so M is left, N touch is. Okay, and as I said, this is, a representation, so we can deduce that here we get as a subspace and P, where M is fixed, but P can take the value from minus J to plus J, is kind of a sub-representation space. And it carries a representation okay, so this was for one of the first natural representation over the group. So let's now look at the left multiplication, and then it will become clear. What I'm trying to, what is the description of a given edge, okay? What exactly is a Hilbert space associated to a given edge? So if now I look at the left multiplication, so let me remind you that if I act on the left, because I want this is a representation, I need to multiply on the left by the inverse. And is that correct? Yeah. Okay, and so now I can do the same thing as before. And you're going to see that the one that is left invariant is so MQ. Q N of G. So again, using the same thing as above, we can deduce what is the left action on my new, my vector basis here. And so if I sum over Q, what I get is MQH inverse over GQ. Okay, so what is that telling you is that now we have this subspace Qn, where Q again can take the value from minus J plus J. It's just another magnetic number. And so this is again a sub. Space, and so now, yeah, this index was left invariant, and it carries a representation that I'm going to denote like this, which is a dual, or if you want, representation or contra gradient. And this dual representation is unitarily equivalent to the dj representation, so they both carry a spin j. But, and here, so the relation you have, what I mean by this thing is that this is the inverse for the inverse group element, but then you have to transpose, or it's what we checked yesterday. So just be careful here, you have the transpose. Okay, so what is the picture we have now with our edge and with a Hilbert space associated to an edge, okay? So our subsystem is an edge. What we've seen yesterday is that this can be seen as the space of square integrable function over the group SU2 for the R measure, okay? But this space can also be decomposed over all the spin J, and now we have that at it carries a dual representation at one vertex of the edge, and the spin J representation at another vertex of the edge. And so now the picture that you have of your edge, so yesterday what we said is that, okay, this is my edge E, I can associate this to my edge, okay, or if you want, now just this vector basis to a given edge. And the way it is written, in fact, is really that you can see that the edge itself is carrying the representation, and then at each vertex, so again, it's oriented. So the origin, the source vertex is going to be the one that carry this representation, so it's the n here, and here you have the m index. Okay, so this is kind of means that you have an angular momentum associated to both ends of the edge. Okay, so this is just to kind of clarify what is the description of this Hilbert space. And it's really going to be useful because what are we going to do now? Of course, as we said, it's really a subsystem. It's even a subsystem of a subsystem, since a graph is already a subsystem of the full theory. So when we're going to now consider a graph, okay, this means that now for each graph, we're going to have, so for each edge of the graph, I'm going to have a representation. And then given the orientation of the edge, so let's consider that this one is only outgoing edges. So I will get here N2, N1, and let's call this one 5, and 5, for example. And what is going to do, so this is just really kinematics. So this is a graph, kind of, it's an oriented graph with some decoration, but then we're going to impose the Gauss constraint, and what the Gauss constraint is going to do is that each node is going to kind of constrain these indices, okay? These indices won't be anything, any of them. We have some condition of them, okay? So here, this is going to be constrained by the Gauss, Okay, so the Gauss constraint is the one that implements the SU2 invariance. And we're going to see how implementing the kind of SU2 invariance is going to be related to implementing some constraint on these indices. So right now, it seems very unrelated. But yeah, we're going to see that in details. Maybe not today, but tomorrow. So this was just to finish on the description on this Hilbert space associated just for a given H. Okay? And having this idea that both now vertices here are going to carry a given a magnetic number, okay, is going to help when we're going to put edges together and even more. So just putting edges together to form a graph is not going to change anything, but when we're going to apply the constraint on this system, okay? And see how imposing SU2 invariance is going to, at the level of the graph, impose some constraint on these vertices. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about that. So now, any questions? You seems all a bit perplexed. So maybe you need time to think about it. We can discuss about that more during the tutorial if you want, if you need some time to think about what this means. Yeah, it's a bit. Okay, so let's try to define the length operator. So in 4D, so the equivalent would be to define an area operator instead of a length operator. And this is related, again, as I told you, we have this recipe how to smear the given variable. So here, we were smearing our connection over an edge, okay, or a path. And then the dual one was going to be also another edge, okay? In 4D, it's going to be a bit different because, so for a given edge, okay, for a given path, the dual, and it's where the triad is going to be smeared. Oh, it's not going to be the triad itself, it's going to be the conjugated momentum of the connection is going to be smeared over a surface, okay? And naturally, what we're going to build is the area operator that is going to kind of measure this surface. And here, maybe something. So, yeah, the way I introduced thing was really to tell you, oh, we have not really well-defined variables. So, in order to have not well-defined, but we have this Poisson bracket that are distributional. So, instead, in order to get rid of this, let's introduce this path and smear our variable over this path. So then it seems that the way graphs are going to appear for you, it can be kind of indeed arbitrary graph. Okay, there is no really constraint on the graph we're going to get. Then in practice, so in 3D indeed, it's not going to be really important because since it's topological, it's a graph independent, so the description is not really depending on the graph structure. In 4D, it's not going to be the case, and it's not very clear. So many people in 4D are going to usually work with graphs that are dual to a triangulation. Okay, so we're going to go back to that, especially when we're going to introduce spin foam. And it's not clear that working with arbitrary graph or just graph dual to triangulation is going to give the same theory, of course. But since we don't have the full theory, we don't really know. So usually, many things are done with graphs that are dual to triangulation. And why is it nice? It's because it's really allow you to have a kind of nice geometrical picture because all this area operator that you're going to define or volume operator can really be seen as the area operators for a triangle of a given of the phase for a tetrahedron, and the volume operator can really be seen as a kind of volume, can be seen as a quantization as the volume for the of this tetrahedron. Okay. You have kind of a nice interpretation of what your classical, how you you compute the volume or area of this geometrical object at the classical level, and quantizing this object gives you kind of your operators. Okay, but here, so we are in 3D, so this curve is going to be dual to another one. So we want to, so maybe to give you kind of, anyway, kind of justification of what is the expression of this length operator, let me give you what would be the length if you have a curve in 2D, then what is the expression of the of this length, of this length, and see where the operator I'm going to define come from. Also, an important point is that the operator I'm going to define is in fact SU2 invariant, okay? And it's going to be defined using this E, and you see that right now you can already guess the E, so the flux operator have a internal index J, okay? So it's going to transform under SU2, it's going to transform as a vector, okay? It has this vector index. So usually, how do you get an invariant under SU2? You don't have so many options here. When you have a vector, you take the scalar product of two vectors, okay? So of course, if it's the same, if it for the same, since we will have one of these operators associated to each edge, if it's for the same, it's what is going to give us the notion of length, length square. If it's not the same, it's more going to give the notion of angles between dual curves, and et cetera, okay? And it's exactly the same idea in 4D. Okay, so first, what is the length? Of a curve. On to the surface. So this can be given by, usually you do an integration, so if I call this curve so then let me introduce this QAB. And where here it's going to be just a special metric. And of course it can be defined in terms of cotriad. And here, if you imagine that you take a kind of, so this is an integration, okay? You can take a Riemann approximation of this integration by subdividing your curve in very small intervals, okay? And this can give you, so if now you look at this as an integral instead of this, you look at the Riemann approximation, so you're going to sum over sub indices, you can we have some here. Where here is kind of okay, so this is really not very rigorous. So here the idea is this is a kind of Riemann. Approximation. So it's kind of give you an idea that your length operator is going to be defined for a dual curve as an operator. And here I'm going to reintroduce the E label. And again, why this operator is nice is because it's also an SU2 invariance operator. Okay. So this is kind of a heuristic justification for the expression. But again, using this operator and having a new interpretation of what is the length, also we could do the same with the angle and everything. And again, in 4D, it's going to be more the area and volume. And we can really show that, indeed, we can characterize some discrete geometry here with, of course, at the quantum level. But if we take a continuum semi-classical limit, we recover what is expected. So there are also kind of other justification that's just this heuristic one. Okay, so now what was the, so this, since we have the action of the right multiplication on our basis, and the flux operator can be written in terms of this right multiplication, we can easily deduce what is the action of Ek on our basis vector. So we get E H bar and then GMP, where I will have to take T equal to 0 of DJ. So it was this Pn of the exponential dk. Okay, so here I'm just exactly using what we have seen for the right multiplication and using the definition of E in terms of a right multiplication operator. Okay, so what do we get here? Okay, so let's see now. What is the action of this operator on my basis? So I'm going to minus from the I squared H bar squared, and then I get the summation over PQ on some DG. Sorry, so you can put that twice. So I guess the second one will be acting on. So I guess the QPTK and then a PN. Okay, and here I should get the J Q N. No. M Q. Okay. So okay, this is correct because what is written in my notes are not correct. So I'm trying just to figure out. So MP, okay. Okay, but so what is important here is that this object here. Maybe not with all the summation, but so the, if we sum over, so here is a summation over k to what I want to define, yeah, is it keeps the summation over p, k, okay, so this is q, p, t, k, sorry. P, n, and I'm going to denote this c, j, q, n, hopefully everything is correct. And this matrix element can be simplified into of the norm squared of this generators, SU2 generators. And you can check that this operator here is going to commute with any of the other generators. So you have to be look at the generator in the same representation here. So this is exercise. Check this. And so what does it mean? If we have an operator that is commuting with the Lie algebra basis, what is this commutator? What is this operator then? Don't remember from your the Lie algebra course. And I guess you use a bit of Lie algebra and Lie group things in QFT, no? So you should be like super on the top of everything. So what does it mean when you have an operator that is commuting with all the Lie algebra bases? Have you heard about the Casimir? And the Schur lemma, what can you say about the Casimir? Okay, so we're going to use that. Okay, this means that is a Casimir operator. And so if you don't know this lemma, this is a very important, but I'm sure you have seen it because usually you use it even to determine the representation of SU2, the group SU2, I guess. So what does it mean? Here, it's going to tell you that it acts on an irreducible representation vector space VG that you can remember that you can kind of see in as using these vector bases, but here you have to fix one of the magnetic number. So here it's M is fixed and N is the normal one, go to minus J. So here it acts on this vector space as the identity operator up to a proportionality coefficient, okay? So that means that Cg here can be written as lambda times the identity for this vector space. And so this means that modulo to a constant, this is the SU2 Casimir, okay? And it can be shown, so I'm not going to do it, but this is also what am I doing? Okay, so here Cg is modulo a constant is the Casimir of SU2. So it's SU2 Casimir. And you could show that lambda in this case is so you can check it if you want, but anyway. What is interesting here is what we get. So here we have this equation. GQn. And this is the identity, okay? So what you get is this minus lambda h bar squared somewhere over Q, G, M, Q, but this is the identity. So it's delta Q, N here. So what you get is that this operator is diagonal on this basis, okay? It's diagonalized by this basis. And here, you just end up with J plus 1 G M N. Okay, so what is now? So here it's a square. What did we learn on this operator? It's eigenvector are given by this set of vector. Then the spectrum is given by, and here, of course, so we are missing some, we would like this to interpret this as the length squared, that we are missing some unit. And where does this come from that we are missing some unit is we never really be careful, you know, we started from an action. But in front of this section, we have some factor here. Okay. And so this means that when you look at what is the conjugated momentum of your connection, you don't exactly get just the epsilon AB times the triad. You get epsilon AB times the triad times this constant in front that is not that has some dimension. Okay. And so when you quantize, you should get dimension. So here, I'm kind of reintroducing the dimension for you. So what would come in front of it would be the Planck scale, the Planck length, that I'm going to give you in a moment if I can recover where I put that. And so here what is interesting is that this is discrete. And so, yeah, in 3D, so you have to be careful because the expression of the Planck length is, of course, depend on which dimension you're talking about. So it's not the same in 3D and 4D. It's because G doesn't have the same. So it's this h bar. So we add the kappa in front of our action that should come here. And the kappa is related to the Newton constant times some other coefficient. And if we don't put C equal to 1, you also have some C. But of course, I don't know if I have a better expression than this kappa, that no one's remember what was the expression. So it's not super useful. Yeah, sorry about that. So yeah, this kappa is the one in front of the action. And yeah, I don't think. Okay, so this is an expression in term of, sorry, I don't have the, and since it's specific to 3D, it's going to be, yeah, sorry. Okay, so this is about this geometrical operator. And the fact that we say in quantum gravity that the space is as a kind of, so in three plus one, we will see that it's not going to be area, and it's not length, but it's area and volume. So we talk about this atomic structure of space. Okay, so the fact that space is discrete, and this don't have to be confused with the fact that we have graph, okay? This is not related to the fact that we introduce graph to, because again, this is just a subsystem, and then we're going to work the full kinematical Hilbert spaces when we take this projective limit, okay? So here, when we say that it's discrete, it's because geometric operators have some discrete eigenvalues, okay? So there is no discreteness here put by hand. It's really coming from the geometrical operators. Okay, any questions here? Okay, so now we have kind of a nice understanding of what is a Hilbert space for our single edge. And so we have this. And now we want to go to for a given graph. So what is a graph? A graph can be seen as, again, it's really going to be related to this relational picture that we have of space, because you can really see a graph have kind of a set of nodes that are going to be related, okay, that have some by edges or not, depending. And this is going to give you some kind of agency relation. You only have agency relation for your graph. And we're going to consider oriented graphs. So the orientation is just really important because we're talking about holonomies. But again, the orientation itself of the graph is not important. We've seen that if we have a H here, then if we choose your other orientation, we just work with the H inverse. Okay, so we still have an holonomy. So a graph is really a set of edge and of nodes and edge relating them together. And so the Hilbert space associated to a graph is really going to be the generalization of what we have seen. It's now we are going to consider the space of function. And now for each edge, so a function associated to a graph, where for each edge we have a group element, okay, SU2 group element. So this is the space of function. So it's SU2. And if I call L, big L this, here it's a number. So the graph is fixed here, okay? We're still talking about a subsystem. So it's a number of edges of my graph gamma. And then we keep this R measure, so we'll have. And in fact, yeah, so the measure, yeah, well, this is not. I'm not going to write this here, this measure, because it's not totally true. There is some work to do for define a mathematically well-defined measure, okay? Because then the question is, when you talk about a graph, well, yeah, so my point here is that really this can be seen as really the tensor product. So to work on really the measure, we will have to, but this can be really seen as a tensor product of all, so let's maybe call that big E, of one edge Hilbert space, okay? And yeah, so you can see that. Sorry, here. So the inner product, in fact, well, simply, so then there are some consistency relation, but I'm not going to introduce that now. So for what we're going to use, the inner product is simply given by, so here, y, yeah. I know why I was confused, and I'm going to. I'm going to explain to you why. So here, in fact, no, there is no issue at all because we're working just for a given graph, okay? I call that differently. No. So it's just really a very simple generalization and the orthonormal basis. So let me finish with just this. Is just by tensoring all the basis function for each edge. So here we can define, I'm using a vector notation, just meaning, so this is for a given graph. Gamma. And it's just by tensoring all E1 for all edges, okay? So the generalization here is straightforward. Where, in fact, it's becoming more complicated, it's so. You understand? So now this is just for a given graph, okay? And the graph is fixed. Again, the full theory is going to take, we need to take a limit. And so the idea would be also, for example, to define the inner, so when we take this limit, this means we consider more or less all possible graph, okay? It's kind of going to be the union of over all possible graph, and then we need to make a completion of the norm over this, for this union. So this is kind of, what is this projective limit doing? But you see that at some point, if it's for all possible graph, what we have to understand is what's the inner product if here we have different graphs, okay? And so here for a given graph, the measure is very well defined, in fact, it's very simple, it's just this R measure for each copy of SU2. Then if you go to the inner product for any graph, okay, so if now your Hilbert space you consider is kind of the union of all possible graph, then you deal with what is called the Hasteka-Lewandowski measure. And so everything, yeah, mathematically, loop quantum gravity at the kinematical level is very well defined. There is no issue, everything has been very well checked. Okay, so this is, so I don't know, in 5 minutes, I don't really have time to talk about the idea, but so here we really started from this continuous variable. Then we introduce just an edge first to introduce this new variable. Then we quantize that as a subsystem, so we got h of e. Then we can, from that, deduce really what is the h, the Hilbert space associated to a given graph, okay, where a graph now is going to be a set of these edges together, related together. And then the next question would be, what is H kind of the total Hilbert space we need, so still kinematical. And here, we need to take this notion of projective limit. Okay, but it's a bit technical, so I don't really want to give too many detail. I rather want to give you kind of what would be the next step and what we're going to. Okay, so here we can say that we're finally done with the first step of, well, even if not really because we didn't do the projective limit, but let's say that we're done with the first step of the Dirac program, okay? Because we can impose all the constraints at the level of the truncated Hilbert space for a given graph, okay? So this is what we're going to do now, is to impose the constraint. So the first one we're going to do is to impose the Gauss constraint, which is supposed to impose this SU2 invariance. And as I already mentioned, it is going to constrain these indices here. And so once you will have imposed the Gauss constraint, which is, so you remember that the second step of the Dirac program for constraint system is now to turn your constraint as operator and to find the physical solution. Okay, so we're going to have a kind of a trick for that, but we're still going to impose the Gauss constraint at the quantum level, okay? So now when we will be doing that, we will have that each edge will be still decorated by this SU2, but now each vertices is going to be decorated with what we call an intertwiner, okay? Which is going to be an invariant tensor in the tensor product of all this representation coming to this edge, to this given node, okay? And so you can really see, and this is what is going to be called a spin network, okay? And in the literature, usually you're going to see that spin network are the basis for your kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. So indeed, in loop quantum gravity, what we call then the kinematical Hilbert space is once the Gauss constraint has already been implemented, okay? So this is maybe a bit confusing. So it's not just this set of objects, we're going already to constrain that. And so now what you're going to get as a spin network is really just a decorated graph where, so it's an oriented graph, colored oriented graph. And the color here are what we call the spin, so the SU2 irreducible representation for each edge, and the intertwiner for each. Vertices. And in 3+1, we're going to see that really, again, if you look at the geometrical operator, here the J are going to be represented, are going to, so if you look at now, the geometrical operator in 3+1 will be the area operator, and you can also define the notion of volume operator. And then you can really interpret this kind of coloring as the J as a quanta of area, okay, and the I as a quanta of volume. Because indeed, this volume operator and this area operator are going to be diagonalized in the spin network basis. And if you look at the spectrum associated to this operator, the area and the area is going to be labeled by this J, and the volume is going to be labeled by this intertwiner thing, okay? So we're going to go back to this 3+1 picture a bit later next week. But so here, yeah, this is to give you what is the next step. So this is to introduce the Gauss constraint and to define the spin network bases, which are really the building block of loop quantum gravity. And then since we're only working in 3D here, in 2+1, then we can impose also the flatness constraint, okay? And so tomorrow we'll do the Gauss constraint and maybe start the flatness constraint. And again, all these constraints have a kind of nice geometrical interpretation of what they're doing in terms of the geometries. And for the flatness constraint, we will consider a specific example, okay? Because we cannot really, either here we can really do that kind of almost in general. Here we need to specify a specific graph and work on it, okay? So we will impose both, and then at the end, we will end up with the physical Hilbert space. Okay, so these are kind of the next step we need to work on. So step for tomorrow is at least the Gauss constraint, so maybe not. So this is step one for tomorrow, and maybe we'll have time to look at the flatness constraint. And 1 plus 2 will give you the physical inverse space. OK? OK, thanks.